The battle for the soul of Islam is playing out in part through old-fashioned rock and roll. Here's a sample of what heavy metal Islam sounds like. This is the Moroccan band Lazy Wall.
Love will never leave us alone. High in the darkness, there must come out a light. Could you be love? Could you be love?
The Moroccan band Lazy Wall, a hard metal version of Bob Marley's Could You Be Loved, is what they were singing. In his new book, Middle East scholar Mark Levine traveled the Islamic Middle East in search of the underground rock metal scene. Mark Levine will be joining us in a minute. But first, are you a Muslim and a heavy metal music fan? Or have you heard any of the hardcore music coming out of the Islamic world? Give us a call. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. Again, 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Joining us now from the studios of KUCI at the University of California, Irvine, is Mark Levine. He's a musician and a Middle East history professor at UC Irvine. His new book is Heavy Metal Islam, Rock Resistance and the Struggle for the Soul of Islam. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
How do you explain the exploding popularity of American-style heavy metal, death metal, hardcore, hip-hop, so on, in the Islamic world?
Well, one of my oldest friends in the Moroccan metal scene, a guy named Reda Zine, put it, I think, best. He said, you know, we play heavy metal because our lives are heavy metal. When you live in a country that has very little hope for the future, it's an authoritarian regime, you know, the economy and politics have little hope to improve, what else are you going to listen to? You're not going to listen to Britney Spears. You're not going to listen to Boys to Men. You're going to want to listen to something hard that reflects it. And really, metal, which, you know, came of age, grew out of, you know, the problems that were happening in the industrialized cities in northern England and in the U.S. when jobs were being lost, and there was a similar sense of hopelessness, really fed into this phenomena. And then later on, so did hip-hop, especially gangster rap, mm-hmm. which spoke to the same kind of feelings that young kids in the poor inner cities had in the United States.
And now, the Arab Middle East, famously now, of course, has the largest population of people under the age of 25, I believe, in the world. And many people, particularly in the West, think of young folks in the Islamic world, and they think extremism. But you spent years traveling the region and just jamming with musicians you were meeting.
Well, it's not just musicians who I don't think are extreme. I think the whole way we define extremism is very problematic. That's one of the things I learned from this book. You know, when you look at al-Qaeda and you call them radicals, really nothing much that al-Qaeda is advocating and its use of violence, none of that is really new. What's really radical are the Muslims, just like the people in the West, some of them, who are trying to actually bring together these two cultures which seem to be in conflict and create something that's not just new but somehow greater than the sum of the parts and really is something that can advance the way Muslims and people in the West and Muslims in the West, how we can all dialogue together and how we can all face common problems. So, for example, the band Lazy Wall that I just performed with at this huge metal and hip-hop festival in Casablanca a couple of weeks ago, you know, at this festival you have booths for AIDS, you have people there advocating for all kinds of political and social causes, you have girls there in hijabs and headscarves who are headbanging, you know, next to kids in goth makeup, you know, and women in full abayas and young children.
But is this happening in generally liberal countries like Morocco and Turkey, or is it happening in countries we often think of as more conservative Muslim societies?
Right. No, you can see this also in Egypt. You know, one of the most developed rock and hard rock scenes in the world is in Pakistan, which is the second largest Muslim country, which has, you know, the most developed music video scene. And the bands there also can be very hard, but also blend together local styles. So this is what surprised me, because when I first heard about metal in the Middle East, I kind of thought the same thing, that this would be something that was just on the margins, just perhaps in more liberal societies. But even in a country like Iran, where there's no really metal is not allowed at all in a public way, there's a big underground scene, and you know, you see kids who might wear, you know, a full headscarf outside, then they go to someone's house, they take it off, and they're listening to really hardcore metal, and that's because it speaks to them a lot more than the official discourse.
It's underground, you say. Why? I mean, is it suppressed?
Well, certainly You know, you can't really generalize at all from country to country. Many of the countries from Morocco to Pakistan have had what you could call satanic metal affairs in the last decade, mm-hmm. where the government has brought charges against musicians and fans for, you know, listening to satanic music and being Satan worshippers. You know, very, really almost comical if you actually look at the charges. But, you know, in countries like Iran, it's clearly prescribed, right? But there's a big underground scene. In a country like Morocco, which had a satanic metal scare in 2003, the kids actually fought back. They fought against the guilty verdicts. They staged, you know, metal concerts outside the courthouse and overturned the verdicts. And then metal became much bigger. And then you have countries like Egypt, where the Grand Mufti actually declared that the metalheads who were arrested in the scare there in 1997 should be executed as apostates if they don't repent. There it took a lot longer, but now it's become more popular again. It's come out of the closet, so to speak, and kids are there. Actually concerts inside Cairo and clubs in Cairo where only 2 years ago they had to be held in villas out in the desert where no one knew they were there and no one really cared what they did.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Mark Levine. He's a musician and a history professor at UC Irvine, author of the book Heavy Metal Islam. Let's go to the phones. Fred is on the line with us from Moorhead, North Carolina. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I've seen the progression of this whole music scene because I lived in the Middle East for about 3 years. And I saw the whole, well, not the whole progression, but I saw the progression of it from going from the more traditional to the Raj. And even people like the Khalid and people like that, they made a big contribution to more modern Arabic music or more music related to the Western style. What does your guest have to say about that?
Mark Levine.
Well, I think actually this is actually a great circle that's coming back. You know, if you listen to the music of American slaves, African American slaves, most of them came from West Africa and a good share of them were Muslims. And there's strong evidence that a lot of the tonality and the melodies that became blues and gospel and eventually rock came out of variations of Muslim calls to prayer, right? And then you think of bands from the 60s like Led Zeppelin, the Rolling Stones, who went to Morocco and other Arab countries. So they really influenced our music. Then we start influencing their music, and now they're coming and taking that kind of metal and remixing it with their own local music traditions and creating something new. So this is something that's really gone on for 30, 40 years. Most of the older musicians I've met, you know, laugh at me when I approach them thinking that this is something new. They've been doing this for longer than I've been alive. And that shows you that these connections, what we think of as globalization, something new, has actually much more longstanding than we imagine.
Fred, thanks so much for the call.
Oh, you're welcome.
Mark Levine, there's a fascinating example you cite in your book, and that is the music of a band called Ocean Land. And I want to play
Orphan Land.
Orphan Land. The song is Ocean Land, I believe.
Yeah.
And I'd like to play some of that music for a moment. Now, Mark Levine, let me get this straight. This is an Israeli band, and you write that it's actually one of the most popular death metal bands among Muslims in the Arab Islamic world.
Well, not only is it the most, perhaps the most popular, you actually can find fans of the band in Jordan and Saudi Arabia who have tattooed the band's logo to their bodies, which is sort of a double violation of traditional Islamic law. A, you're not supposed to have tattoos, and probably you're not supposed to have tattoos of Israeli death metal bands. That's even one step above, you know, doing something that'll get you in trouble, especially in Saudi Arabia. Yeah, you know, this band, I think, summarizes everything. When I was in Egypt before I went to Israel and Palestine, I mentioned to some of the bands I was with there that I was going to meet them, and they were all like, oh my God, give them the metal horns from us. They're such an amazing band.
Wow.
We love them. And when I got there, I understood why. Because, you know, the lead guitarist's parents come from Libya and Iraq. They're Jews who immigrated from Libya and Iraq. He grew up immersed in Arab culture and speaking Arabic. They called the band Orphan Land because they felt this holy, sacred land, Israel, Palestine, had been forsaken and abandoned by the two peoples who were fighting over it and using the most unsacred, ways to try to secure control of it. And I think metalheads across the region identify with that because they feel orphaned by their society.
How do they get access to the music? I mean, orphaned land is abandoned in Israel. How do kids in Saudi Arabia get to hear it?
Well, there's two ways. First, certainly the internet now makes any kind of censorship almost impossible, right? But the second way is through festivals. Orphanland actually just played at a festival in Istanbul, where, you know, Israelis often play in Istanbul. And metal fans from the Arab world will go there to meet them. So there are spaces, and also at the huge metal festivals like Wacken in Germany. So there are ways that bands can meet up, both virtually online and also in reality. And they forge these kind of connections. And when you think about Muslim, I mean, religious Muslim kids who pray five times a day, but also their favorite metal band is Orphanland because they were the first band to blend in Oriental, quote-unquote, elements into brutal death metal, which is why you heard that kind of screamed vocals. That's what makes it death metal. Mm. You know, that inspired them. And the fact that it is an Israeli doing it, really, they don't care. They're not thinking in the same kind of paradigms that their parents are, you know, and that the older Islamists are. And the more interesting thing is that even the younger religious kids who we might think are more conservative, like younger members of the Muslim Brotherhood or in Morocco, they don't care so much anymore about these kind of older political conflicts. They're much more interested in democracy, in pluralism, intolerance. So this is a real sea change in this emerging generation of the Muslim world, and the book attempts to tell that story in a way that probably hasn't been done before.
It's fascinating. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Sabur is on the line with us from Scottsdale, Arizona. Sabur, I hope I pronounced that correctly.
Yep, that is correct.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I grew up in Pakistan. I spent the first 16 years over there in the 1990s, and back then it was pretty much just the mainstream pop music when I was growing up, and there was only like a couple of media channels that were nationally available. But since I've come here, because of the Pervez Musharraf, he's opened up the media, and also internet has really spread out. I came here in 2001, and I started an underground band website for a friend of mine who was in Pakistan, and he had an underground band, heavy metal band, and he wanted me to put it on the internet. And since then, since 2001, I have over 300 plus underground bands, all from Pakistan and India, that have sprung up since. And I mean, I grew up, I was a teenager when I was in Pakistan, but I never, ever heard any underground bands. So internet has really, really helped grow the underground music in Pakistan, India.
Mark Levine, internet as well in other parts of the Islamic world?
Yeah, certainly internet is key, but Pakistan is a really unique place and in some way a harbinger of, I think, how the music business is going to develop. You know, first of all, I was up in Peshawar, which is the home base, of course, of the Taliban, and every day now you could read in the New York Times or Washington Post, what have you, stories how the Taliban are spreading throughout the Northwest Frontier Province and Peshawar. But is also, you know, one of the best rock bands in Pakistan, Sajid and Zeeshan, are there. You know, and there's a great music scene there and a great liberal tradition in Peshawar, which was in many ways destroyed by the war in the first war against the Soviets in Afghanistan, but is still trying to survive there. And what you have in Pakistan starting in the 90s is bands like Junoon and other bands really taking this kind of cheesy Pakistani pop, adding in elements of really hard American and British and European rock, and creating this incredible new hybrid, which has just taken the world by storm, in India, too. And so now you have Pakistani musicians and Indian musicians constantly playing in each other's countries and working together, and that's clearly culturally breaking the ice between India and Pakistan. But the other interesting thing is that in Pakistan now, because of the ubiquity of cheap but very high-quality recording technologies, anyone can basically record a professional sounding song for $2,000, shoot a video for another $2,000, send it to one of the dozen music video channels. If they like it, they'll play it. And if it starts getting requested, all of a sudden you're famous. And then the music business industry will come and buy your album. And so this kind of do-it-yourself ethos is really symbolic of the music scenes across the Middle East. And it's, I think, one of the models that we should learn from here, but it's also one of the ways they're combating their own kind of globalized corporate privatized music scene with companies like Rotana and other huge conglomerates which are trying to stifle music and make it into, you know, cookie cutter music the same way as happened in the U.S. So there's very interesting similarities in the struggles, and we could be learning from them rather than what we assume, which is usually the other way around.
Saber, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you, guys.
In the remaining moments we have left, Mark Levine, I wanted to ask you about this notion over the battle for the soul of Islam, and I've seen some of the work you've written, and you write, in that battle for the soul of Islam, I would put my money on Ozzy, of course, Ozzy Osbourne, over Osama. Why is that?
Well, you know, if you have a historical memory, and I'm a historian, you think of the Eastern Bloc, if you think of when Ozzy and other metalheads appeared in the Soviet Union in its last days and heralded the fall of communism, or you think about the Czech bands like the Plastic People and other bands that heralded the reforms in Czechoslovakia. You know, when I see who the real radicals are and the kids who are really willing to put themselves on the line and want to change their society in a positive way, it's the kids who are not just metalheads, not everyone likes metal, but who have that kind of attitude, which is going to challenge authority, but in a positive way. You know, for these kids, one person said, you know what, metal is a music about death, but for us, it's a music that affirms life. Mark, and it's that positive attitude which is really the thing that gives me hope in an otherwise fairly hopeless situation.
Mark Levine is the author of Heavy Metal Islam, Rock Resistance and the Struggle for the Soul of Islam. He joined us from the studios of KUCI at the University of California, Irvine. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we'll leave you with a song called You Mala, which Mark Levine recorded with the Moroccan band Cafe Mira. Tomorrow, Ira Flatow is here with Science Friday. Neil Conan's back on Monday. I'm Guy Raz. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.